any Dornish army that tried to stand before them, even without Aegon and Beleriand. No doubt he had the right of that, but the issue was never proved, for the Dornish men never offered battle. Instead, they withdrew before King Aegon's host, burning their crops in the field and poisoning every well. The invaders found the Dornish watchtowers in the Red Mountains slighted and abandoned. In the high passes, Aegon's vanguard found its way barred by a wall of sheep carcasses, shorn of all wool and too rotted to eat. The king's army was already running short of food and fodder by the time they emerged from the prince's pass to face the Dornish sands. There, Aegon divided his forces, sending Lord Tyrell south against Uthor Ulla, Lord of the Hellholt, while he himself turned eastward to besiege Lord Fowler in his mountain fastness Skyreach. It was the second year of autumn, and winter was thought to be close at hand. In that season, the invaders hoped, the heat in the deserts would be less, water more plentiful. But the Dornish sun proved unrelenting as Lord Tyrell marched toward Hellholt. In such heat, men drink more, and every waterhole and oasis in the army's path had been poisoned. Horses began to die, more every day, followed by their riders. The proud knights discarded their banners, their shields, their very armour. Lord Tyrell lost a quarter of his men, and almost all his horses, to the Dornish sands, and when at last he reached the Hellholt, he found it abandoned. Oris Baratheon's attack fared little better. His horses struggled on the stony slopes of the narrow, twisting passes, but many balked completely when they reached the steepest sections of the road, where the Dornish had chiseled steps into the mountains. Boulders rained down on the Hand's knights from above, the work of defenders the Stormlanders never saw. Where the Boneway crossed the River Will, Dornish archers suddenly appeared as the column was making its way across a bridge, and arrows rained down by the thousands. When Lord Oris ordered his men to fall back, a massive rockfall cut off their retreat. With no way forward and no way back, the Stormlanders were butchered like hogs in a pen. Oris Baratheon himself was spared, along with a dozen other lords thought worth the ransom, but they found themselves captives of Will, the savage mountain lord called Widow Lover. King Aegon himself had more success. Marching eastward through the foothills where runoff from the heights provided water, and game was plentiful in the valleys, he took the castle Skyreach by storm, won Eirin Wood after a brief siege. The Lord of the Tor had recently died, and his steward surrendered without a fight. Farther east, Lord Toland of Ghost Hill sent forth his champion to challenge the king to single combat. Aegon accepted and slew the man, only to discover afterward that he had not been Toland's champion, but his fool. Lord Toland himself was gone. As was Meriah Martell, the Princess of Dorne, when King Aegon descended upon Sunspear on Beleriand to find his sister Rhaenys there before him. After burning the Planky town, she had taken Lemonwood, Spotswood, and Stinkwater, accepting obeisances from old women and children, but nowhere finding an actual enemy. Even the Shadow City outside the walls of Sunspear was half deserted, and none of those who remained would admit to any knowledge of the whereabouts of the Dornish lords and princess. "The yellow toad has melted into the sands," Queen Rhaenys told King Aegon. Aegon's answer was a declaration of victory. In the great hall at Sunspear he gathered together what dignitaries remained and told them that Dorne was now part of the realm, that henceforth they would be his leal subjects, that their former lords were rebels and outlaws. Rewards were offered for their heads, particularly that of the yellow toad, Princess Meriah Martell. Lord John Rosby was named Castellan of Sunspear and Warden of the Sands, to rule Dorne in the king's name. Stewards and castellans were named for all the other lands and castles the conqueror had taken. Then King Aegon and his host departed back the way they had come, west along the foothills and through the Prince's Pass. They had hardly reached King's Landing before Dorne erupted behind them. Dornish spearmen appeared from nowhere, like desert flowers after a rain. Skyreach, Eirin Wood, the Tor and Ghost Hill were all recaptured within a fortnight, their royal garrisons put to the sword. Aegon's castellans and stewards were allowed to die only after long torment. It was said that the Dornish lords had a wager over who could keep their captive alive the longest whilst dismembering them. Lord Rusby, Castellan of Sunspear and Warden of the Sands, had a kinder end than most. After the Dornish men swarmed in from the Shadow City to retake the castle, he was bound hand and foot, dragged to the top of the Spear Tower, and thrown from a window, by none other than the aged Princess Maria herself. Soon only Lord Tyrell and his host remained. King Aegon had left Tyrell behind when he departed. Hellholt, a strong castle on the River Brimstone, was thought to be well situated to deal with any revolts. But the river was sulphurous, and the fish taken from it made the high gardeners sick. House Corgyle of Sandstone had never submitted, and Corgyle's spearmen cut down Tyrell's foraging parties and patrols whenever they strayed too far west. The Vaiths of Vaith did the same to the east. When word of the defenestration of Sunspear reached the Hellholt, Lord Tyrell gathered his remaining strength and set off across the sands. His announced intention was to capture Vaith, march east along the river, retake Sunspear and the Shadow City, and punish Lord Rosby's murderers. But somewhere, east of the Hellholt, amidst the red sands, Tyrell and his entire army disappeared. No man of them was ever seen again. Aegon Targaryen was not a man to accept defeat. The war would drag on for another 7 years, though after 6 AC the fighting degenerated into an endless bloody series of atrocities, raids and retaliations, broken up by long periods of inactivity, a dozen short truces, and numerous murders and assassinations. In 7 AC, Orys Baratheon and the other lords who had been taken captive on the Boneway were ransomed back to King's Landing for their weight in gold, but on their return it was found that the widow lover had lopped off each man's sword hand, so they might never again take up swords against Dorne. In retaliation, King Aegon himself descended on the mountain fastnesses of the Wills with Beleriand, and reduced half a dozen of their keeps and watchtowers to heaps of molten stone. The Wills took refuge in caves and tunnels beneath their mountains, however, and the widow lover lived another 20 years. In 8 AC, a very dry year, Dornish raiders crossed the Sea of Dorne on ships provided by a pirate king from the Stepstones, attacking half a dozen towns and villages along the south shore of Cape Wrath, and setting fires that spread through half the Rainwood. "Fire for fire," Princess Maria is reported to have said. This was not something the Targaryens would allow to go unanswered. Later that same year, Visenya Targaryen appeared in the skies of Dorne, and Vhagar's fires were loosed upon Sunspear, Lemonwood, Ghost Hill, and the Tor. In 9 AC, Visenya returned again, this time with Aegon himself flying beside her, and Sandstone, Vaith, and the Hellholt burned. The Dornish answer came the next year, when Lord Fowler led an army through the Prince's Pass and into the Reach, moving so swiftly that he was able to burn a dozen villages and capture the great border castle Night Song, before the Marcher lords realized the foe was upon them. When word of the attack reached Old Town, Lord Hightower sent his son Adam with a strong force to retake Night Song, but the Dornish had anticipated just that thing. A second Dornish army under Ser Geoffrey Dane came down from Starfall and attacked the city. Old Town's walls proved too strong for the Dornish to overcome, but Dane burned fields, farms, and villages for 20 leagues around the city and slew Lord Hightower's younger son Garmon when the boy led a sortie against him. Sir Adam Hightower reached Night Song, only to find that Lord Fowler had put the castle to the torch and its garrison to the sword. Lord Carron and his wife and children had been carried back to Dorne as captives. Rather than pursue, Sir Adam returned at once to Old Town to relieve the city, but Sir Geoffrey and his army had melted back into the mountains as well. Old Lord Manfred Hightower died soon after. Sir Adam succeeded his father as the Lord of the Hightower, as Old Town cried out for vengeance. King Aegon flew Beleriand to Highgarden to take counsel with his Warden of the South, but Theo Tyrell, the young lord, was most reluctant to contemplate another invasion of Dorne after the fate that had befallen his father. Once again, the king unleashed his dragons against Dorne. Aegon himself fell upon Skyreach, vowing to make the Fowler seat a second Harrenhal. Visenya and Vhagar brought fire and blood to Starfall, and Rhaenys and Meraxes returned once more to the Hellholt, where tragedy struck. The Targaryen dragons, bred and trained to battle, had flown through storms of spears and arrows on many occasions, and suffered little harm. The scales of a full-grown dragon were harder than steel, and even those arrows that struck home seldom penetrated enough to do more than enrage the great beasts. But as Meraxes banked above the Hellholt, a defender atop the castle's highest tower triggered a scorpion, and a yard-long iron bolt caught the queen's dragon in the right eye. Meraxes did not die at once, but came crashing to earth in mortal agony, destroying the tower and a large section of the Hellholt's curtain wall in her death throes. Whether Rhaenys Targaryen outlived her dragon remains a matter of dispute. Some say that she lost her seat and fell to her death, others that she was crushed beneath Meraxes in the castle yard. A few accounts claim the queen survived her dragon's fall, only to die a slow death by torment in the dungeons of the Ullers. The true circumstances of her demise will likely never be known, but Rhaenys Targaryen, sister and wife to King Aegon I, perished at the Hellholt in Dorne in the 10th year after the conquest. The next 2 years were the years of the dragon's wrath. Every castle in Dorne was burned thrice over as Beleriand and Vhagar returned time and time again. The sands around the Hellholt were fused into glass in places, so hot was Beleriand's fiery breath. The Dornish lords were forced into hiding, but even that did not buy them safety. Lord Fowler, Lord Vaith, Lady Toland, and 4 successive lords of the Hellholt were murdered, one after the other, for the Iron Throne had offered a lord's ransom in gold for the head of any Dornish lord. Only 2 of the killers lived to collect their rewards, however, and the Dornish men took their reprisals, repaying blood with blood. Lord Connington of Griffin's Roost was killed whilst hunting. Lord Mertens of Mistwood poisoned with his whole household by a cask of Dornish wine. Lord Fell smothered in a brothel in King's Landing. Nor were the Targaryens themselves exempt. The king was attacked thrice, and would have fallen on 2 of those occasions but for his guards. Queen Visenya was set upon one night in King's Landing. 2 of her escorts were slain before Visenya herself cut down the last attacker with Dark Sister. The most infamous act of that bloody age occurred in 12 AC, when Will of Will, the widow lover, arrived uninvited at the wedding of Sir John Caffron, heir to Faunton, to Alice Oakheart, daughter to the Lord of Old Oak. Admitted through a postern gate by a treacherous servant, the Will attackers slew Lord Oakheart and most of the wedding guests, then made the bride look on as they gelded her husband. Afterward they took turns, raping Lady Alice and her handmaids, then carried them off and sold them to a Mirish slaver. By then, Dorne was a smoking desert, beset by famine, plague, and blight. A blasted land, traders from the Free Cities called it. Yet House Martell still remained, unbowed, unbent, unbroken, as their words avowed. One Dornish knight, brought before Queen Visenya as a captive, insisted that Meriah Martell would sooner see her people dead than slaves to House Targaryen. Visenya replied that she and her brother would be glad to oblige the princess. Age and ill health finally did what dragons and armies could not. In 13 AC, Meriah Martell, the Yellow Toad of Dorne, died abed, whilst having intimate relations with a stallion, her enemies insisted. Her son, Nymor, succeeded her as Lord of Sunspear and Prince of Dorne. 60 years old, his health already failing, the new Dornish prince had no appetite for further slaughter. He began his reign by sending a delegation to King's Landing to return the skull of the dragon Meraxes and offer King Aegon terms of peace. His own heir, his daughter Daria, led the embassy. Prince Nymor's peace proposals encountered strong opposition in King's Landing. Queen Visenya was hard set against them. "No peace without submission," she declared, and her friends on the king's council echoed her words. Oris Baratheon, who had grown bent and bitter in his later years, argued for sending Princess Daria back to her father less a hand. Lord Oakheart sent a raven suggesting that the Dornish girl be sold into the meanest brothel in King's Landing, till every beggar in the city has had his pleasure of her. Aegon Targaryen dismissed all such proposals. Princess Daria had come as an envoy, under a banner of peace, and would suffer no harm under his roof, he vowed. The king was weary of war, all men agreed, but granting the Dornish men peace without submission would be tantamount to saying that his beloved sister Rhaenys had died in vain, and that all the blood and death had been for naught. The lords of his small council further cautioned that any such peace could be seen as a sign of weakness, and might encourage fresh rebellions, which would then need to be put down. Aegon knew that the Reach, the Stormlands, and the Marches had suffered grievously during the fighting, and would neither forgive nor forget. Even in King's Landing, the king dared not let the Dornish outside the Aegon fort without a strong escort, for fear that the small folk of the city would tear them to pieces. For all these reasons, Grand Maester Lucan wrote later, the king was on the point of refusing the Dornish proposals and continuing the war. It was then that Princess Daria presented the king with a sealed letter from her father. "For your eyes only, Your Grace." King Aegon read Prince Nymor's words in open court, stone-faced and silent, whilst seated on the Iron Throne. When he rose afterward, men said, his hand was dripping blood. He burned the letter and never spoke of it again, but that night he mounted Beleriand and flew off across the waters of Blackwater Bay to Dragonstone upon its smoking mountain. When he returned the next morning, Aegon Targaryen agreed to the terms proposed by Nymor. Soon thereafter he signed a treaty of eternal peace with Dorne. To this day, no one can say with certainty what might have been in Daria's letter. Some claim it was a simple plea from one father to another, heartfelt words that touched King Aegon's heart. Others insist it was a list of all those lords and noble knights who had lost their lives during the war. Certain septons even went so far as to suggest that the missive was ensorcelled, that it had been written by the Yellow Toad before her death, using a vial of Queen Rhaenys's own blood for ink, so that the king would be helpless to resist its malign magic. Grand Maester Clegg, who came to King's Landing many years later, concluded that Dorne no longer had the strength to fight. Driven by desperation, Clegg suggested, Prince Nymor might have threatened that should his peace be refused, he would engage the faceless men of Braavos to kill King Aegon's son and heir, Queen Rhaenys's boy, Aenys, then but 6 years old. It may be so, but no man will ever truly know. Thus ended the First Dornish War, 4-13 AC. The Yellow Toad of Dorne had done what Harren the Black, the Two Kings, and Torrhen Stark could not. She had defeated Aegon Targaryen and his dragons. Yet, north of the Red Mountains, her tactics earned her only scorn. Dornish courage became a mocking name for cowardice amongst the lords and knights of Aegon's kingdoms. The toad hops into her hole when threatened, wrote one scribe. Another said, Merya fought like a woman, with lies and treachery and witchery. The Dornish victory, if victory it was seen to be dishonourable, and the survivors of the fight, and the sons and brothers of those who had fallen, promised one another that another day would come, and with it a reckoning. Their vengeance would need to wait for a future generation, and the accession of a younger, more bloodthirsty king. Though he would sit the Iron Throne for another 24 years, the Dornish conflict was Aegon the Conqueror's last war. Three heads had the dragon. Governance under King Aegon the First. Aegon the First Targaryen was a warrior of renown, the greatest conqueror in the history of Westeros. Yet many believe his most significant accomplishments came during times of peace. The Iron Throne was forged with fire and steel and terror, it is said, but once the throne had cooled, it became the seat of justice for all Westeros. The reconciliation of the Seven Kingdoms to Targaryen rule was the keystone of Aegon I's policies as king. To this end, he made great efforts to include men, and even a few women, from every part of the realm in his court and councils. His former foes were encouraged to send their children, chiefly younger sons and daughters, as most great lords desire to keep their heirs close to home, to court, where the boys served as pages, cupbearers and squires, the girls as handmaidens and companions to Aegon's queens. In King's Landing, they witnessed the king's justice at first hand, and were urged to think of themselves as leal subjects of one great realm, not as Westermen or Stormlanders or Northmen. The Targaryens also brokered many marriages between noble houses from the far ends of the realm, in hopes that such alliances would help tie the conquered lands together and make the Seven Kingdoms one. Aegon's queens, Visenya and Rhaenys, took a special delight in arranging these matches. Through their efforts, young Ronald Arryn, Lord of the Eyrie, took a daughter of Torrhen Stark of Winterfell to wed, whilst Loren Lannister's eldest son, heir to Casterly Rock, married a Redwine girl from the Arbor. When three girls, triplets, were born to the Evenstar of Tarth, Queen Rhaenys arranged betrothals for them with House Corbrae, House Hightower, and House Harlaw. Queen Visenya brokered a double wedding between House Blackwood and House Bracken, rivals whose history of enmity went back centuries, matching a son of each house with a daughter of the other to seal the peace between them. And when a Rowan girl in Rhaenys' service found herself with child by a scullion, the queen found a knight to marry her in White Harbour, and another in Lannisport who was willing to take on her bastard as a fosterling. Though none doubted that Aegon Targaryen was the final authority in all matters relating to the governance of the realm, his sisters Visenya and Rhaenys remained his partners in power throughout his reign. Save perhaps for good Queen Alysanne, the wife of King Jaehaerys I, no other queen in the history of the Seven Kingdoms ever exercised as much influence over policy as the Dragon's sisters. It was the king's custom to bring one of his queens with him wherever he travelled, whilst the other remained at Dragonstone or King's Landing, oft as not, seated on the Iron Throne, ruling on whatever matters came before her. Though Aegon had designated King's Landing as his royal seat, and installed the Iron Throne in the Aegon Fort's smoky long hall, he spent no more than a quarter of his time there. Full as many of his days and nights were spent on Dragonstone, the island citadel of his forebears. The castle below the Dragonmont had 10 times the room of the Aegon Fort, with considerably more comfort, safety, and history. The Conqueror was once heard to say that he even loved the scent of Dragonstone, where the salt air always smelled of smoke and brimstone. Aegon spent roughly half the year at his two seats, dividing his time between them. The other half he devoted to an endless royal progress, taking his court from one castle to another, guesting with each of his great lords in turn, Gulltown and the Eyrie, Harrenhal, Riverrun, Lannisport and Casterly Rock, Craighall, Old Oak, Highgarden, Old Town, the Arbor, Hornhill, Ashford, Storm's End, and Evenfall Hall had the honour of hosting his grace many times. But Aegon could and would turn up almost anywhere, sometimes with as many as 1,000 knights and lords and ladies in his train. He journeyed thrice to the Iron Islands, twice to Pike and once to Great Wick, spent a fortnight at Sisterton in 19 AC, and visited the North 6 times, holding court thrice in White Harbour, twice at Barriton, and once at Winterfell on his very last royal progress in 33 AC. "It is better to forestall rebellions than to put them down," Aegon famously said when asked the reason for his journeys. A glimpse of the king in all his power, mounted on Beleriand the Black Dread, and attended by hundreds of knights glittering in silk and steel, did much to instill loyalty in restless lords. The small folk needed to see their kings and queens from time to time as well, the king added, and know that they might have the chance to lay their grievances and concerns before him. And so they did. Much of every royal progress was given over to feasts and balls and hunts and hawking, as every lord attempted to outdo the others in splendour and hospitality, But Aegon also made a point of holding court wherever he might travel, whether from a dais in some great lord's castle or a mossy stone in a farmer's field. Six maesters travelled with him to answer any questions he might have on local law, customs, and history, and to make note of such decrees and judgments as his grace might hand down. A lord should know the land he rules, the conqueror later told his son Aenys, and through his travels Aegon learned much and more about the Seven Kingdoms and its peoples. Each of the conquered kingdoms had its own laws and traditions. King Aegon did little to interfere with those. He allowed his lords to continue to rule much as they always had, with all the same powers and prerogatives. The laws of inheritance and succession remained unchanged. The existing feudal structures were confirmed. Lords both great and small retained the power of pit and gallows on their own land, and the privilege of the first knight, wherever that custom had formerly prevailed. Aegon's chief concern was peace. Before the conquest, wars between the realms of Westeros were common. Hardly a year passed without someone fighting someone somewhere. Even in those kingdoms said to be at peace, neighbouring lords oft settled their disputes at sword point. Aegon's accession put an end to much of that. Petty lords and landed knights were now expected to take their disputes to their liege lords and abide by their judgments. Arguments between the great houses of the realm were adjudicated by the crown. "The first law of the land shall be the king's peace," King Aegon decreed, "and any lord who goes to war without my leave shall be considered a rebel and an enemy of the Iron Throne." King Aegon also issued decrees regularizing customs, duties, and taxes throughout the realm, whereas previously every port and every petty lord had been free to exact however much they could from tenants, small folk, and merchants. He also proclaimed that the holy men and women of the faith, and all their lands and possessions, were to be exempt from taxation, and affirmed the right of the faith's own courts to try and sentence any septon, sworn brother, or holy sister accused of malfeasance. Though not himself a godly man, the first Targaryen king always took care to court the support of the faith and the high septon of Old Town. King's Landing grew up around Aegon and his court, on and about the three great hills that stood near the mouth of the Blackwater Rush. The highest of those hills had become known as Aegon's High Hill, and soon enough the lesser hills were being called the Senyas Hill and the Hill of Rhaenys, their former names forgotten. The crude Motte-and-Bailey fort that Aegon had thrown up so quickly was neither large enough nor grand enough to house the king and his court, and had begun to expand even before the conquest was complete. A new keep was erected, all of logs and 50 feet high, with a cavernous long hall beneath it, and a kitchen made of stone and roofed with slate in case of fire across the bailey. Stables appeared, then a granary. A new watchtower was raised, twice as tall as the older one. Soon the Aegon fort was threatening to burst out of its walls, so a new palisade was raised, enclosing more of the hilltop, creating space enough for a barracks, an armory, a sept, and a drum tower. Below the hills, wharves and storehouses were rising along the riverbanks, and merchants from Old Town and the free cities were tying up beside the longships of the Valerians and Celtigars, where only a few fishing boats had previously been seen. Much of the trade that had gone through Maidenpool and Duskendale was now coming to King's Landing. A fish market sprung up along the riverside, a cloth market between the hills. A customs house appeared. A modest sept opened on the Blackwater in the hull of an old cog, followed by a stouter one of daub and wattle on the shore. Then a second sept, twice as large and thrice as grand, was built atop the Senyas Hill, with coin sent by the High Septon. Shops and homes sprouted like mushrooms after a rain. Wealthy men raised walled manses on the hillside, whilst the poor gathered in squalid hovels of mud and straw in the low places between. No one planned King's Landing. It simply grew. But it grew quickly. At Aegon's first coronation, it was still a village, squatting beneath a Motte-and-Bailey castle. By his second, it was already a thriving town of several thousand souls. By 10 AC, it was a true city, almost as large as Gulltown or White Harbour. By 25 AC, It had outgrown both to become the third most populous city in the realm, surpassed only by Lannisport and Old Town. Unlike its rivals, however, King's Landing had no walls. It needed none, some of its residents were known to say. No enemy would ever dare attack the city so long as it was defended by the Targaryens and their dragons. The king himself might have shared these views originally, but the death of his sister Rhaenys and her dragon Meraxes in 10 AC and the attacks upon his own person undoubtedly gave him cause. And in the 19th year after the conquest, word reached Westeros of a daring raid in the Summer Isles, where a pirate fleet had sacked Tall Trees Town and carried off 1,000 women and children as slaves, along with a fortune in plunder. The accounts of the raid greatly troubled the king, who realized that King's Landing would be similarly vulnerable to any enemy shrewd enough to fall upon the city when he and Visenya were elsewhere. Accordingly, his grace ordered the construction of a ring of walls about King's Landing, as high and strong as those that protected Old Town and Lannisport. The task of building them was conferred upon Grand Maester Gawen and Sir Osmond Strong, the Hand of the King. To honour the Seven, Aegon decreed that the city would have 7 gates, each defended by a massive gatehouse and defensive towers. Work on the walls began the next year, and continued until 26 AC. Sir Osmond was the king's fourth hand. His first had been Lord Oris Baratheon, his bastard half-brother and companion of his youth, but Lord Oris was taken captive during the Dornish War and suffered the loss of his sword hand. When ransomed back, his lordship asked the king to be relieved of his duties. "The king's hand should have a hand," he said. "I will not have men speaking of the king's stump." Aegon next called on Edmund Tully, Lord of Riverrun, to take up the handship. Lord Edmund served from 7 to 9 AC, but when his wife died in childbed, he decided that his children had more need of him than the realm, and begged leave to return to the Riverlands. Alton Celtigar, Lord of Claw Isle, replaced Tully, serving ably as hand, until his death from natural causes in 17 AC, after which the king named Sir Osmond Strong. Grand Maester Gawen was the third in that office. Aegon Targaryen had always kept a maester on Dragonstone, as his father and father's father had before him. All the great lords of Westeros and many lesser lords and landed knights relied upon maesters trained in the citadel of Old Town to serve their households as healers, scribes, and counsellors, to breed and train the ravens who carried their messages, and write and read those messages for lords who lacked those skills, help their stewards with the household accounts, and teach their children. During the conquest, Aegon and his sisters each had a maester serving them, and afterward the king sometimes employed as many as 6 to deal with all the matters brought before him. But the wisest and most learned men in the 7 kingdoms were the arch-maesters of the citadel, each of them the supreme authority in one of the great disciplines. In 5 AC, King Aegon, feeling that the realm might benefit from such wisdom, asked the conclave to send him one of their own number to advise and consult with him on all matters relating to the governance of the realm. Thus was the office of Grand Maester created at King Aegon's request. The first man to serve in that capacity was Archmaester Olidar, Keeper of Histories, whose ring and rod and mask were bronze. Though exceptionally learned, Olidar was also exceptionally old, and he passed from this world less than a year after taking up the mantle of Grand Maester. To fill his place, the conclave selected Archmaester Lyons, whose ring and rod and mask were yellow gold. He proved more robust than his predecessor, serving the realm until 12 AC, when he slipped in the mud, broke his hip, and died soon thereafter, whereupon Grand Maester Gawen was elevated. The institution of the king's small council did not come into its full bloom until the reign of King Jaehaerys the Conciliator, but that is not to suggest that Aegon I ruled without the benefit of counsel. He is known to have consulted often with his various grand maesters, and his own household maesters as well. On matters relating to taxation, debts, and incomes, he sought the advice of his masters of coin. Though he kept one septon at King's Landing and another at Dragonstone, the king more oft wrote to the High Septon of Old Town on religious issues, and always made a point of visiting the Starry Sept during his yearly circuit. More than any of these, King Aegon relied upon the king's hand, and of course upon his sisters, the queens Rhaenys and Visenya. Queen Rhaenys was a great patron to the bards and singers of the Seven Kingdoms, showering gold and gifts on those who pleased her. Though Queen Visenya thought her sister frivolous, there was a wisdom in this that went beyond a simple love of music. For the singers of the realm, in their eagerness to win the favor of the queen, composed many a song in praise of House Targaryen and King Aegon, and then went forth and sang those songs in every keep and castle and village green from the Dornish marches to the wall. Thus was the conquest made glorious to the simple people, whilst Aegon the Dragon himself became a hero king. Queen Rhaenys also took a great interest in the small folk, and had a special love for women and children. Once, when she was holding court in the Aegon Fort, a man was brought before her for beating his wife to death. The woman's brothers wanted him punished, but the husband argued that he was within his lawful rights, since he had found his wife abed with another man. The right of a husband to chastise an erring wife was well established throughout the Seven Kingdoms, save in Dorne. The husband further pointed out that the rod he had used to beat his wife was no thicker than his thumb, and even produced the rod in evidence. When the queen asked him how many times he had struck his wife, however, the husband could not answer. But the dead woman's brothers insisted there had been 100 blows. Queen Rhaenys consulted with her maesters and septons, then rendered her decision. An adulterous wife gave offence to the Seven, who had created women to be faithful and obedient to their husbands, and therefore must be chastised. As God has but 7 faces, however, the punishment should consist of only 6 blows, for the 7th blow would be for the stranger, and the stranger is the face of death. Thus, the first 6 blows the man had struck had been lawful. But the remaining 94 had been an offence against gods and men and must be punished in kind. From that day forth, the rule of 6 became a part of the common law, along with the rule of thumb. The husband was taken to the foot of the hill of Rhaenys, where he was given 94 blows by the dead woman's brothers, using rods of lawful size. Queen Visenya did not share her sister's love of music and song. She was not without humour, however, and for many years kept her own fool, a hirsute hunchback called Lord Monkeyface, whose antics amused her greatly. When he choked to death on a peach pit, the queen acquired an ape and dressed it in Lord Monkeyface's clothing. "The new one is cleverer," she was wont to say. Yet there was darkness in Visenya Targaryen. To most of the world she presented the grim face of a warrior, stern and unforgiving. Even her beauty had an edge to it, her admirers said. The oldest of the 3 heads of the dragon, Visenya was to outlive both of her siblings, and it was rumoured that in her later years, when she could no longer wield a sword, she delved into the dark arts, mixing poisons and casting malign spells. Some even suggest that she might have been a kinslayer, and a kingslayer, though no proof has ever been offered to support such calumnies. It would be a cruel irony if true, for in her youth no one did more to protect the king. Visenya twice wielded Dark Sister in Aegon's defence when he was set upon by Dornish cutthroats. Suspicious and ferocious by turns, she trusted no one but her brother. During the Dornish war she took to wearing a shirt of mail, night and day, even under her court clothes, and urged the king to do the same. When Aegon refused, Visenya grew furious. "Even with Blackfyre in your hand, you are only one man," she told him, "and I cannot always be with you." When the king pointed out that he had guardsmen around him, Visenya drew Dark Sister and slashed him across the cheek so quickly the guards had no time to react. "Your guards are slow and lazy," she said. "I could have killed you as easily as I cut you. You require better protection." King Aegon, bleeding, had no choice but to agree. Many kings had champions to defend them. Aegon was the lord of the 7 kingdoms, therefore he should have 7 champions, Queen Visenya decided. Thus did the Kingsguard come into being, a brotherhood of 7 knights, the finest in the realm, cloaked and armoured all in purest white, with no purpose but to defend the king, giving up their own lives for his, if need be. The seigneur modelled their vows on those of a night's watch. Like the black-cloaked crows of the wall, the white swords served for life, surrendering all their lands, titles, and worldly goods to live a life of chastity and obedience, with no reward but honour. So many knights came forward to offer themselves as candidates for the king's guard that King Aegon considered holding a great tourney to determine which of them was the most worthy. Visenya would not hear of it, however. To be a king's guard knight required more than just skill at arms, she pointed out. She would not risk placing men of uncertain loyalty about the king, regardless of how well they performed in a melee. She would choose the knights herself. The champions she selected were young and old, tall and short, dark and fair. They came from every corner of the realm. Some were younger sons, others the heirs of ancient houses who gave up their inheritances to serve the king. One was a hedge knight, another bastard-born. All of them were quick, strong, observant, skilled with sword and shield, and devoted to the king. These are the names of Aegon's seven, as written in the White Book of the King's Guard. Sir Richard Root, Sir Addison Hill, bastard of Cornfield, Sir Gregor Good, Sir Griffith Good, his brother, Sir Humphrey the Mummer, Sir Robin Darklin, called Dark Robin, and Sir Corlys Valerian, Lord Commander. History has confirmed that Visenya Targaryen chose well. Two of her original seven would die protecting the king, and all would serve with valour to the end of their lives. Many brave men have followed in their footsteps since, writing their names in the white book and donning the white cloak. The king's guard remains a synonym for honour to this day. 16 Targaryens followed Aegon the Dragon to the Iron Throne before the dynasty was at last toppled in Robert's Rebellion. They numbered amongst them wise men and foolish, cruel men and kind, good men and evil. Yet, if the Dragon Kings are considered solely on the basis of their legacies, the laws and institutions and improvements they left behind, the name of King Aegon I belongs near the top of the list, in peace as well as war. The Sons of the Dragon. King Aegon I Targaryen took both of his sisters to wife. Rhaenys and Visenya were dragon riders, with the silver-gold hair, purple eyes, and beauty of true Targaryens. Elsewise, the two queens were as unlike each other as any two women could be, save in one other respect. Each of them gave the king a son. Aenys came first. Born in 7 AC to Aegon's younger wife, Rhaenys, the boy was small at birth and sickly. He cried all the time, and it was said that his limbs were spindly, his eyes small and watery, and that the king's maesters feared for his survival. He would spit out the nipples of his wet nurse and give suck only at his mother's breasts, and rumours claimed that he screamed for a fortnight when he was weaned. So unlike King Aegon was he that a few even dared suggest that his grace was not the boy's true sire, that Aenys was some bastard born of one of Queen Rhaenys's many handsome favourites, the son of a singer or a mummer or a mime. And the prince was slow to grow as well. Not until he was given the young dragon Quicksilver, a hatchling born that same year on Dragonstone, did Aenys Targaryen begin to thrive. Prince Aenys was three when his mother Queen Rhaenys and her dragon Meraxes were slain in Dorne. Her death left the boy prince inconsolable. He stopped eating, and even began to crawl as he had when he was one, as if he had forgotten how to walk. His father despaired of him, and rumours flew about the court that King Aegon might take another wife, as Rhaenys was dead and Visenya childless and perhaps barren. The king kept his own counsel on these matters, so no man could say what thoughts he might have entertained. But many great lords and noble knights appeared at court with their maiden daughters, each more comely than the last. All such speculation ended in 11 AC, when Queen Visenya suddenly announced that she was carrying the king's child. A son, she proclaimed confidently, and so he proved to be. The prince came squalling into the world in 12 AC. No newborn was ever more robust than Maegor Targaryen, maesters and midwives agreed. His weight at birth was almost twice that of his elder brother. The half-brothers were never close. Prince Aenys was the heir apparent, and King Aegon kept him close by his side. As the king moved about the realm from castle to castle, so did the prince. Prince Maegor remained with his mother, sitting by her side when she held court. Queen Visenya and King Aegon were oft apart in those years. When he was not on a royal progress, Aegon would return to King's Landing and the Aegon Fort, whilst Visenya and her son remained on Dragonstone. For this reason, lords and commons alike began to refer to Maegor as the Prince of Dragonstone. Queen Visenya put a sword into her son's hand when he was three. Supposedly, the first thing he did with the blade was butcher one of the castle cats, men said. Though more like this tale was a calumny devised by his enemies many years later. That the prince took to swordplay at once cannot be denied, however. For his first master-at-arms, his mother chose Sir Gawain Corbray, as deadly a knight as could be found in all the Seven Kingdoms. Prince Aenys was so oft in his sire's company that his own instruction in the chivalric arts came largely from the knights of Aegon's Kingsguard, and sometimes the king himself. The boy was diligent, his instructors agreed, and did not want for courage, but he lacked his sire's size and strength, and was never more than adequate as a fighter, even when the king pressed Blackfyre into his hands, as he did from time to time. Aenys would not disgrace himself in battle, his tutors told one another, but no songs would ever be sung about his prowess. Such gifts as this prince possessed lay elsewhere. Aenys was a fine singer himself, as it happened, with a strong, sweet voice. He was courteous and charming, clever without being bookish. He made friends easily, and young girls seemed to dote on him, be they high-born or low. Aenys loved to ride as well. His father gave him coursers, palfreys, and destriers, but his favourite mount was his dragon, Quicksilver. Prince Maegor rode as well, but showed no great love for horses, dogs, or any animal. When he was eight, a palfrey kicked him in the stables. Maegor stabbed the horse to death and slashed half the face off the stable boy who came running at the beast's screams. The Prince of Dragonstone had many companions through the years, but no true friends. He was a quarrelsome boy, quick to take offence, slow to forgive, fearsome in his wrath. His skill with weapons was unmatched, however. A squire at eight, he was unhorsing boys 4 and 5 years his elder in the lists by the time he was 12, and battering seasoned men-at-arms into submission in the castle yard. On his 13th name day and 25 AC, his mother, Queen Visenya, bestowed her own Valyrian steel blade, Dark Sister, upon him, half a year before his marriage. The tradition amongst the Targaryens had always been to marry kin to kin. Wedding brother to sister was thought to be ideal. Failing that, a girl might wed an uncle, a cousin, or a nephew, a boy, a cousin, aunt, or niece. This practice went back to old Valyria, where it was common amongst many of the ancient families, particularly those who bred and rode dragons. The blood of the dragon must remain pure, the wisdom went. Some of the sorcerer princes also took more than one wife when it pleased them, though this was less common than incestuous marriage. In Valyria, before the doom, wise men wrote, 1,000 gods were honoured, but none were feared. So few dared to speak against these customs. This was not true in Westeros, where the power of the faith went unquestioned. The old gods were still worshipped in the north, and the drowned god in the Iron Islands, but in the rest of the realm there was a single god with 7 faces, and his voice upon this earth was the high septon of Old Town. And the doctrines of the faith, handed down through centuries from Andalos itself, condemned the Valyrian marriage customs as practiced by the Targaryens. Incest was denounced as a vile sin, whether between father and daughter, mother and son, or brother and sister, and the fruits of such unions were considered abominations in the sight of gods and men. With hindsight, it can be seen that conflict between the faith and House Targaryen was inevitable. Indeed, many amongst the most devout had expected the High Septon to speak out against Aegon and his sisters during the conquest, and were most displeased when the Father of the Faithful instead counselled Lord Hightower against opposing the dragon, and even blessed and anointed him at his second coronation. Familiarity is the father of acceptance, it is said. The High Septon, who had crowned Aegon the Conqueror, remained the Shepherd of the Faithful until his death in 11 AC, by which time the realm had grown accustomed to the notion of a king with two queens who were both wives and sisters. King Aegon always took care to honour the faith, confirming its traditional rights and privileges, exempting its wealth and property from taxation, and affirming that septons, scepters, and other servants of the Seven accused of wrongdoing could only be tried by the faith's own courts. The accord between the faith and the Iron Throne continued all through the reign of Aegon I. From 11 AC to 37 AC, six High Septons wore the Crystal Crown. His Grace remained on good terms with each of them, calling at the Starry Sept each time he came to Old Town. Yet the question of incestuous marriage remained, simmering below the courtesies like poison. Whilst the High Septons of King Aegon's reign never spoke out against the king's marriage to his sisters, neither did they declare it to be lawful. The humbler members of the faith, village septons, holy sisters, begging brothers, poor fellows, still believed it sinful for brother to lie with sister, or for a man to take two wives. Aegon the Conqueror had fathered no daughters, however, so these matters did not come to a head at once. The sons of the dragon had no sisters to marry, so each of them was forced to seek elsewhere for a bride. Prince Aenys was the first to marry. In 22 AC, he wed the lady Alyssa, the maiden daughter of the Lord of the Tides, Aethon Valerian, King Aegon's Lord Admiral and Master of Ships. She was 15, the same age as the prince, and shared his silvery hair and purple eyes as well, for the Valerians were an ancient family descended from Valyrian stock. King Aegon's own mother had been a Valerian, so the marriage was reckoned one of cousin to cousin. It soon proved both happy and fruitful. The following year, Alyssa gave birth to a daughter. Prince Aenys named her Rhaena, in honour of his mother. Like her father, the girl was small at birth, but unlike him, she proved to be a happy, healthy child, with lively lilac eyes and hair that shone like beaten silver. It was written that King Aegon himself wept the first time his granddaughter was placed in his arms, and thereafter doted upon the child, mayhaps in some part because she reminded him of his lost queen Rhaenys, in whose memory she had been named. As the glad tidings of Rhaenys' birth spread across the land, the realm rejoiced, save perhaps for Queen Visenya. Prince Aenys was the unquestioned heir to the Iron Throne, all agreed, but now an issue arose as to whether Prince Maegor remained second in the line of succession, or should be considered to have fallen to third behind the newborn princess. Queen Visenya proposed to settle the matter by betrothing the infant Rhaena to Maegor, who had just turned 11. Aenys and Alyssa spoke against the match, however, and when word reached the Starry Sept, the High Septon sent a raven, warning the king that such a marriage would not be looked upon with favour by the faith. His High Holiness proposed a different bride for Maegor, his own niece, Cerys Hightower, maiden daughter to the Lord of Old Town, Manfred Hightower, not to be confused with his grandsire of the same name. King Aegon, mindful of the advantages of closer ties with Old Town and its ruling house, saw wisdom in the choice and agreed to the match. Thus it came to pass that in 25 AC, Maegor Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, wed Lady Cerys Hightower in the Starry Sept of Old Town, with the High Septon himself performing the nuptials. Maegor was 13, the bride 10 years his senior, but the lords who bore witness to the bedding all agreed that the prince made a lusty husband, and Maegor himself boasted that he had consummated the marriage 12 times that night. "I made a son for House Targaryen last night," he proclaimed as he broke fast. The son came the next year, but the boy, named Aegon after his grandsire, was born to Lady Alyssa and fathered by Prince Aenys. Once again, celebrations swept the Seven Kingdoms. The little prince was robust and fierce, and had a warrior's look about him, declared his grandsire Aegon the Dragon himself. While many still debated whether Prince Maegor or his niece Rhaena should have precedence in the order of succession, it seemed beyond question that Aegon would follow his father Aenys, just as Aenys would follow Aegon. In the years that followed, other children came one after the other to House Targaryen, to the delight of King Aegon, if not necessarily that of Queen Visenya. In 29 AC, Prince Aegon acquired a baby brother, when Alyssa gave Prince Aenys a second son, Viserys. In 34 AC, she gave birth to Jaehaerys, her fourth child and third son. In 36 AC came another daughter, Alysanne. Princess Rhaena was 13 when her little sister was born, but Grand Maester Gowan observed that the girl delighted so in the babe that one might think she was the mother herself. The eldest daughter of Aenys and Alyssa was a shy, dreamy child who seemed to be more comfortable with animals than other children. As a little girl, she often hid behind her mother's skirt or clung to her father's leg in the presence of strangers. But she loved to feed the castle cats, and always had a puppy or two in the bed. Though her mother provided her with a succession of suitable companions, the daughters of lords, great and small, Rhaena never seemed to warm to any of them, preferring the company of a book. At the age of 9, however, Rhaena was presented with a hatchling from the pits of Dragonstone, and she and the young dragon she named Dreamfire bonded instantly. With her dragon beside her, the princess slowly began to grow out of her shyness. At the age of 12, she took to the skies for the first time, and thereafter, though she remained a quiet girl, no one dared to call her timid. Not long after, Rhaena made her first true friend in the person of her cousin, Larissa Valerian. For a time, the two girls were inseparable, until Larissa was suddenly recalled to Driftmark to be wed to the second son of the Evenstar of Tarth. The young are nothing if not resilient, however, and the princess soon found a new companion in the Hand's daughter, Samantha Stokeworth. It was Princess Rhaena, legend says, who put a dragon's egg in Princess Alysanne's cradle, just as she had for Prince Jaehaerys 2 years earlier. If those tales be true, from those eggs came the dragons Silverwing and Vermithor, whose names would be writ so large in the annals of the years to come. Princess Rhaena's love for her siblings and the realm's joy at each new Targaryen princeling was not shared by Prince Maegor or his mother, Queen Visenya, for each new son born to Aenys pushed Maegor farther down in the line of succession, and there were still those who claimed he stood behind Aenys's daughters, too. And all the while, Maegor himself remained childless, for Lady Cerys did not quicken in the years that followed their marriage. On tourney ground and battlefield, however, Prince Maegor's accomplishments far exceeded those of his brother. In the great tourney at Riverrun in 28 AC, Maegor unhorsed 3 knights of the King's Guard in successive tilts before falling to the eventual champion. In the melee, no man could stand before him. Afterward, he was knighted on the field by his father, who dubbed him with no lesser blade than Blackfyre. At 10 and 6, Maegor became the youngest knight in the Seven Kingdoms. Other feats followed. In 29 AC and again in 30 AC, Maegor accompanied Osmond Strong and Aethon Valerian to the Stepstones to root out the Lycene pirate king Sargosso San, and fought in several bloody affrays, showing himself to be both fearless and deadly. In 31 AC, he hunted down and slew a notorious robber knight in the Riverlands, the so-called Giant of the Trident. Maegor was not yet a dragon rider, however. Though a dozen hatchlings had been born amidst the fires of Dragonstone in the later years of Aegon's reign, and were offered to the prince, he refused them all. When his young niece Rhaena, in only her 12th year, took to the sky astride Dreamfire, Maegor's failure became the talk of King's Landing. Lady Alyssa teased him about it one day in court, wondering aloud whether, "My good brother is afraid of dragons." Prince Maegor darkened in rage at the jape, then replied coolly that there was only one dragon worthy of him. The last 7 years of the reign of Aegon the Conqueror were peaceful ones. After the frustrations of his Dornish War, the king accepted the continued independence of Dorne and flew to Sunspear on Beleriand on the 10th anniversary of the peace accords to celebrate a feast of friendship with Darya Martell,